This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us today. Today we're going to do what people often do on a Main Street. They brag about their young people, and we've got some bragging to do. The Scholastic Art and Writing Awards recognize creative teens. And this year, North Dakota had its best showing ever, with six students winning national awards. The Red River Valley Writing Project and the Plains Art Museum are the affiliates for North Dakota. And today, Main Street's Ashley Thornburg visits with the Writing Project's Kelly Saucy and Neetha Clater. She's with the Plains Art Museum.
Kelly, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Neetha, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
So North Dakota had a fantastic showing here with six national awards, the best the state has ever done. How does that make you feel? Kelly, we'll start with you.
I'm thrilled because I am all about finding ways for our students in North Dakota to have access to national awards and scholarships.
And Neetha?
Yeah, likewise. We're really excited about all of the national award winners this year and the fact that this program's been in the state for just 4 years and we're receiving that sort of national recognition feels really gratifying for the students, the educators, and our organizing team.
Yeah, to only have this contest in the state for 4 years and to already have hundreds of entries in the state and then six national placements here, that seems to me that this was hitting a button here that was kind of missing in the state.
Yes, I was pretty sure that the talent was out there, but prior to Red River Valley Writing Project partnering with Plains Art Museum to serve as the state affiliate for Scholastic Art and Writing Awards, there were only 20 entries from the entire state of North Dakota. After we started serving as affiliate, we had 120 the first year, then 200 the second year, then 300, then 400, mm-hmm. and it just continues to increase each year as teens and their teachers find out about this great opportunity.
And what does that mean, serve as the affiliate for the state?
So we partner together to serve as the affiliate for both art and writing. And that means we publicize the awards, we organize the adjudication, we put on a state ceremony, Plains Art exhibits the work, and we pass on our Gold Key winners for consideration for national awards.
Okay. Why did the Plains Art Museum want to get involved with this?
I think we saw this as a great opportunity to serve the entire state of North Dakota and educators and grades 7 through 12 students. There are not a lot of opportunities to recognize art and writing in the state for middle and high school students. Mm-hmm. So the ceremony that Kelly mentioned gives us an opportunity to really honor and show that the work that these students are creating is appreciated by the state at large.
So I want to know the process of the Red River Valley Writing Project and the Plains Art Museum. I mean, I know you said publicize the awards and everything, but like with the State Poetry Out Loud competition, there's an educator and coaching the students to do this poetry and then taking them to these competitions. Are you involved in helping coach the students or judging them? What's the process there?
Our role is mainly in adjudication.
Okay.
And I have to tell you, Ashley, I really love the rubric that is used for Scholastic Art and Writing Awards because it's unique in the field of education. It's equal parts creativity, personal voice or vision, and technical skill. And I think nowhere do we have the creativity and innovation of teens rewarded so much in a rubric. So that's something I really like about the adjudication.
Okay.
And the adjudication process that Kelly mentioned involves using regional artists and writers and educators and critics and experts in the field, and we gather them to review all completed submissions at the state level. Mm-hmm. And then they apply that rubric to all of the submissions, and we really, it's a competitive awards process. We really only accept about 25%. They receive any level of award at the state level.
Not only that, but adjudication is blind. So our judges have no idea where a student came from or who they are, what their name is. They're only looking at that creativity that the student is expressing through their art or writing.
That's wonderful. Who are the judges? And we'll start on the writing side.
Well, there are a variety of people. We certainly do rely on a lot of our teachers in the Red River Valley Writing Project. They're wonderful volunteers, but that's only a part of it. We also try to get published authors and the Society of Children's Book Writers International Dakotas chapter has also been a wonderful volunteer partner. Also, individual famous writers like Hyde Erdrich, who is a poet in the cities and originally from Turtle Mountains, and John Billman, who's a flash fiction writer, writes for Outside Magazine and lives in Wisconsin, as well as younger folks. We try to get a variety of ages, a variety of genders.
A variety of ethnicities and cultural perspectives as well. This year's art judges included local artists and educators, an art critic, curators. So a lot of folks that have a really interesting perspective that they bring to each panel. For the art adjudication, there are three judges assigned per category. So if there's a split vote, there's a third voice to split the decision. Okay. And I will say there's often long discussions. So we really carefully consider each piece that's submitted.
And then as it goes on into the national level, are you familiar with the judging process? How is it? Is it different at all, or is it basically the same judging process but with a national audience now?
You got it, Ashley. It's pretty much the same. The rubric is the same. They're looking also to reward creativity and innovation in teens and to really reward those teens who are developing their individual voice through art or writing. They have some pretty famous people they recruit, and those folks are recognized at the national ceremony in Carnegie Hall in New York City.
Do you get to go to that?
I have been once, and I'm hoping that Neetha will be able to go in the future.
Yeah, would love to.
That would be great. And the students in North Dakota, and we have six different winners here. We have students from Bismarck and Fargo and
Tower City.
Tower City. Mm-hmm. Yeah, students really across the state here working on this. Are they going to that national competition in Carnegie, or the award ceremony, I should say?
I know of at least one writer.
Yeah, they received the invitation to go, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then it's funding that trip, so that's
okay.
Something that they individually can do, or
sometimes their districts will contribute, and sometimes I know last year a student had a GoFundMe page that that funded her trip to Carnegie Hall. So, we haven't found that rich donor yet who sends students to the national ceremony. We're looking for that.
Yes.
Well, let's talk about some of the students here. We'll start with Jacob Bloomquist at Maple Valley High School in Tower City, receiving the American Visions Award for an untitled photograph. Can you kind of paint a mental picture of this photograph and how it ended up getting this level recognition?
Yeah, Jacob submitted several different photographs to this year's competition and had six that received awards at the state level. And I'm recalling my visual memory. So the untitled photograph that received the American Visions and Gold Key Award at the national level was using Polaroid film taken from the Impossible Project, so the reissue of Polaroid film. And it's a really surrealist, dark image that has a red light and somebody that's covered in a sheet kind of in a corner. So it's like a surreal landscape, I would say, that really paints a kind of dark and ethereal mood. The other photograph that received national recognition is by Jude Dill, and Jude goes to Davies High School with educator Jasmine Reinke. That photo is a portrait of one of their fellow students. So it's a black and white photograph that's a really well done portrait.
We use that for the cover of the writing anthology this year. We loved it.
Yeah. So really strong photographs coming out of this year, and I'm really grateful that two received national recognition.
And we have Olivia Drake, also of Davies High School, and that's in Fargo, with the American Voices Award and gold medal for the short story First Steps to Freedom. How's Olivia?
Yeah, Olivia's writing is beautiful, and she's such a young writer, too. I expect we'll see more work from her in the future, but this is told from a child's perspective, and she really creates this amazing world where the child ends up having to deal with more than any child should, and it's a moving piece, and it takes you in a place you didn't really expect it would go. So very innovative young writer.
It's nice to be able to marvel at the wisdom of young people. You know, you think they just can't do the dishes or, you know, something like that. But then when you really let them be themselves, it can be so impressive. We've got another Olivia from Horizon Middle School in Bismarck with the gold medal for the poem Dream.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to say about what you just said, Ashley, with students being able to do whatever they want. The other thing that's really unique about Scholastic Art and Writing Awards, and Olivia and the other writers take full advantage of this, is they have complete freedom of expression. Mm. There are no limits on subject matter. And so when youth do have the freedom to go wherever they want with their writing, it is surprising where they take us. And it can be quite emotional to read through the anthology. Those of us who have taken part in editing it have spent time crying, laughing. It's quite an emotional journey as you see the range of topics and emotions of the young people who've done the writing.
Another young writer, another Olivia, in fact, Horizon Middle School in Bismarck with a gold medal for the poem Dream. How is she as a poet?
So what's amazing about Olivia as a poet is she has such a wide range in terms of language and experiments a lot with the structure of the poem. Both she creates some of her own patterns of rhyme and does some things that we don't normally see young poets doing.
Another winner in Bismarck, Ainsley Sabo, personal essay on the color in black and white films, and another Sana Kalathawa, I hope I'm getting that correct, Horizon Middle School in Bismarck, for a science fiction story, Enter the Woods. How do you want to comment on these two pieces?
Yeah, so critical essay, you would think we would have more entries in this category, but we don't have that many. And so it was really wonderful to see something that could have started out as a classroom assignment being taken in a little bit further to really become a unique piece, the color and black and white photography. And look out, because Horizon Middle School had a lot of writing winners, and they just kind of burst on the scene this year.
Okay.
And there was a whole contingent of them recognized at the state ceremony this year. So that's pretty exciting what they have going on in their writing program at their school.
One thing that stands out to me about this award process is that it's open to kids as young as in the seventh grade, and they can enter until the 12th grade here. Usually something like this open for seniors and then scholarships for college. What kind of doors does this open for students, and maybe especially at that middle school level?
Yeah, as we mentioned earlier, it is, you know, there's a lot of competition. There's only a certain number of works selected at the state level. So when a middle school student receives an award, it's a huge accolade and I think a great confidence booster. We also encourage them to continue to submit, because we know that, you know, there's a spectrum of creativity. Like, you know, what they make in seventh grade is expressing a story that may evolve and their interests may evolve as they move into the high school level. So it's really exciting when there's a middle school student that receives an award and is recognized at that level.
And it can be discouraging for students who don't win an award, but we try to encourage them to try again the following year and to take a look at that rubric, too, and really think about the originality of their ideas and pushing them maybe beyond where they started. So we do encourage students to try again if they're not recognized in any one year.
I imagine this is kind of a nice recruiting tool for some art schools.
Oh, yes. Colleges definitely look at these award winners because these are the best and brightest and most creative teens in the country. And so, like, the Art Institute of Chicago and other prominent programs definitely look to offer scholarships to students who are national winners.
I know it's only been organized in the state for 4 years, but have you seen trends at all? Do kids tend to write or photograph or you know, there's 29 different categories here, but mm-hmm. are there trends?
In the art categories, we see a couple different trends. So we do see a large number of photographs, and that's increased each year. So I think there's, across the state, a strong interest in photography. And then painting is the second most popular category, and drawing and illustration. Now, thematically, we do see some trends, and oftentimes they're responding to current events or socio-political things that are happening countrywide, nationwide.
Right. So in the writing, personal essay memoir is always a big category for us, poetry also, and short story. And we would love to see more senior portfolios in the future. We haven't had too many entries in that. We'd love to see more dramatic scripts. In terms of reflecting back current events, we see that very much in the writing. So whatever is going on politically in our country, it oftentimes is reflected in the student writing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Outside of this competition, the Red River Valley Writing Project has a lot going on here. Mm-hmm. You want to give us kind of a synopsis of what you do?
Yeah. So our main mission is to support the teaching of writing from kindergarten through college. And the main way that we've done that since 1999, when the site started at UND, is through the Summer Institute, which is an intensive institute in the teaching of writing for teachers from K through college. And that involves them developing themselves as writers, because we believe in order to be a good teacher of writing, one should also have an active writing practice and be
sure.
able to speak to that, and teaching demonstrations and so forth. More recently, in the past couple of years, we've been very active in the College Career and Community Writers Program, which is about teaching source-based argument writing, especially writing that comments on community issues and results in authentic writing that's available in the community. And that's a National Writing Project program that's had some awesome research results, which is why I pursued that. And there was an article on it in the most recent issue of American Federation of Teachers Journal.
Mm. So. A lot of people, when it comes to writing, some people are very concerned about the changes in technology and kids just texting versus long handwriting. And then other people embrace it in sort of the sense of whatever you're writing on, just keep writing. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
So I think that the issue is much more complex than people think. Some people feel that texting means students are not writing enough, that somehow it's replaced more traditional forms of writing. In fact, the amount of student writing, if you look at all of it that students do, has increased in recent years. It may not look like the writing we did in school, but they are writing. They're communicating. They are socially constructing meaning with each other. And so we need to look under the surface and understand that better in order to be the best teachers of those students.
Nita, what's your role at the Plains Art Museum?
I serve as Director of Education and Social Engagement.
Okay. And I know that the Plains Art Museum somewhat recently went to a free admission model.
Yeah, we did.
What have you seen in terms of admission, engagement, reaction to that?
Yeah, we have seen over a 300% increase in our daily visitors, which is great. I think removing that barrier to access to the museum was really important to us, because our mission is to connect art, artists, and audiences to foster creative, resilient, and welcoming communities. So that piece about a welcoming community and resiliency, and how the arts can play a role in that, removing our admission fee opens our doors for really anyone to come in and experience what we're doing.
And what made that possible, to go to the free admission model?
A variety of funders, and, you know, a little bit of rethinking our budget and how we're spending the money that we do spend. But it's really thanks to our donors and sponsors, which there's a real mosaic of donors and sponsors each year.
All right.
There are two funders, actually, that support Scholastic Art and Writing this year. So Wells Fargo and Fredrickson and Byron are our annual sponsors for the program.
Okay. Nita, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Kelly, thank you for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The Red River Valley Writing Project's Kelly Saucy. and Neetha Klater with the Plains Art Museum, talking with our Ashley Thornburg. You can find out more about the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards at artandwriting.org, more about Plains Art at plainsart.org, and more about the Red River Valley Writing Project with a Google search. Next, Main Street contributor Alan Kleinsaucer remembers third grade.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
The plight of missing and murdered Indigenous women too often goes unnoticed.
Native people deserve the same support and attention that every other demographic gets.
I'm independent producer Meg Luther Lindholm, inviting you to join me for this week's Prairie Public Presents. The program is Testimonies, which brings people with similar life experiences and challenges together to talk about them.
I get out there and I couldn't believe there's no help. There's no one. There's a half a dozen people. And I thought, that's all she's worth?
On Testimonies, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, 4 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Alan Jack Kleinsaucer grew up on his parents' farm near Chaseley in central North Dakota. The farm was homesteaded by his grandfather, who came here in the migration of Germans from Russia. Alan has recorded stories of his youth in a book titled Memories of Dakota Jack, 1935-1956. We asked him to record a few of his essays, and today we'll hear about third grade.
In the fall of 1943, I started my third grade at the country school. My teacher was Evelyn Haluski. She was a sister to my first grade teacher, Fred Haluski. Evelyn was a strict teacher and made the kids pay attention in class, but we learned a lot from her. She had a way about her that would make you want to learn all you can. In the wintertime, we always had a lot of fun playing in the snow. Most winters, we would have a lot of snow in North Dakota. The wind would blow and the snow and make big flakes. After a big snowstorm, the banks of the snow would get hard, and we would cut blocks of snow and build igloo huts, like building a log cabin. If the bank of snow were high, real high, then we would make a cave by digging into the side of the bank. Inside the hut, it would be real nice when the wind was blowing outside. It was a nice shelter to sit and talk at recess time or sometimes before school or after school. The kids made a lot of plans in these huts. Some were good and some were not so good. When the school day was over, we were always glad to get home and learn what our parents had done throughout the day. Evelyn rented a room at our place and stayed with us in the winter time. Most of the time, the country roads were blocked, so she could not drive. That year, the weather temperature was below zero most of the winter. During the winter, when my teacher stayed with us, I tried to be real good in school because I was always afraid that she would tell my parents if I did something wrong in school during the day. But I think she respected me and I respected her, so we seemed to get along real good. I don't know if she ever told my parents any of the things that I did in school, either good or bad. If she did, I can't remember being confronted by my parents to the best of my knowledge.
Alan Kleinsaucer currently lives in Rapid City, South Dakota. A second volume of stories is titled 50 Years of Family Memories, 1957-2007. Coming up on Main Street after the news, Mark Trahant offers a commentary on the consequences of a trade war, and small farm advocate Ross Lockhart talks about the movement and an upcoming event by the Northern Small Farm Alliance. Here's Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's GOP convention is over, but the battle for the U.S. House seat is just warming up. State Senator Kelly Armstrong won the party's endorsement, but State Senator Tom Campbell is mounting a primary election challenge. Campbell was asked if he got a fair chance at the convention.
But as far as a fair shake with the district chairs and stuff, I would say probably not, because most of them made their decisions up several weeks before. That part I don't think was fair because it had nothing to do with the core values of any candidate. It was just right away before they even, you had a chance to tell them what you're for. It's, if you go in the primary, I'm against you. And that's what's always been kind of frustrating.
Campbell says he wants the people to be heard, not just those at the convention.
I want the majority of the people just to vote for themselves. Keep it real simple. Why wouldn't you want to have all the people vote, not just less, you know, a half a percent? It's just, I don't understand. I'm missing something, but that's the way I look at it.
Campbell says the convention process may need to be reevaluated. The penalty for assaulting a police officer in Minnesota could be going up. The House Ways and Means Committee approved a bill by Republican Brian Johnson that would change a physical assault against a peace officer from a gross misdemeanor to a felony. Representative Jerry Herthouse says he supports the measure but isn't sure it will make a difference.
Bringing attention to the rotting and the moral decay of our society as we continue to see increasingly the amount of assaults, both by people who get involved in these confrontations, has not been unique.
At least one committee member wondered if ongoing assaults will deter people from the law enforcement profession. Representative Johnson says they've already noticed a trend.
There's job openings all over. There's people applying for the jobs, but they don't qualify. We're one of the few states that require licensing before you can even apply for the job.
The felony provision would carry a maximum sentence of 2 years in prison and or a $4,000 fine. The measure now goes to the full House for consideration.
Oh, it definitely is the winter that never ends, it feels like.
Hydrologist Amanda Lee is with the National Weather Service office in Grand Forks. She says the ongoing winter-like weather has so far not created much of a change in the flood forecast for the Red River Valley and the Devil's Lake Basin. She says they will be watching events as the first of two weather systems could hit the state on Wednesday. Lee says the first system is not expected to have much impact on moisture levels. The wild card is the second storm. Lee says at this time there is not a clear picture on what that system could bring.
It's kind of still up in the air about where it could affect the most, but as of right now, it does look like it'll kind of impact that far southern North Dakota and into South Dakota and west central Minnesota. So we will see some precipitation with that. It could be some high amounts in some places, possibly some rain and then some more snow.
Lee says there has been some thawing of the ground. She says once the frost is out, any new moisture will be absorbed. Lee says the exit of the frost will also let forecasters create better models on this year's flood threat. She says those forecasts could begin as soon as next week. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thank you for joining us on Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is a professor of journalism at the University of North Dakota, though he'll leave that post at the end of the academic year for Washington, D.C., to serve as the editor for Indian Country Today. He's also the author of a blog called Trahant Reports, and today his commentary is about the potential consequences of a trade war with China.
Make no mistake, the outcome, when it finally occurs, is a dollar and cents issue that will impact the daily lives of Native people, tribal governments, and businesses. Why? A tariff is a tax. It's a tax that's paid every time someone buys a product that's on a country's tariff list. And now so many agricultural products, such as soybeans, will be taxed by China. According to the National Congress of American Indians, agriculture is increasingly important to Native economies, representing the economic backbone of more than 200 tribal communities, according to the Census of Agriculture. In 2007, annual Indian agricultural production exceeded $1.4 billion. Agriculture represents one risk in a trade war. Representative Tom Cole, our Oklahoma, wrote last month, "Free trade contributes to our national prosperity as well. However, having open markets is not an invitation for others to take advantage of us." Cole called tariffs bad news for his state. Cole told CNBC Friday that outside of agriculture, the trade issue is a net plus, because somebody is finally doing something about China, which has simply ripped us off since we let them in the World Trade Organization. A potential trade war also has huge implications for global warming. The Trump administration, of course, has attacked virtually every climate policy from the past administration. And the first action in this trade dispute involves solar panels. Now the trade war could upend extractive industries, especially coal. China has not levied a tariff on coal, but it's widely expected because of the industry's ties to President Trump. China is the world's largest importer of coal. So tribes that mine coal such as the Crow Nation in Montana, have looked toward China and Asian markets as a way to make coal great again. But other tribes along the shipping route, such as the Lummi Nation in Washington, see dirty coal trains bound for Asia as a threat to their salmon and their treaty rights. There is a connection between global trade and global warming. A report by the United Nations says this issue presents an important policy conundrum. Behind every trade transaction, there is a product process and, in turn, associated greenhouse gas emissions. Policies that modify trade can influence emissions, while policies for reducing emissions can also influence trade. So a trade war could slow commerce and the emissions that cause global warming. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can read Mark's commentaries online at TrahantReports.com. Next on Main Street, the small farm movement wants to grow.
The State Historical Society of North Dakota, as part of their Sensational Sunday series, presents the Good Government Summit, a timely discussion about ethics in government and how North Dakota citizens rate theirs. Sunday, April 15th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. Humanities scholar and host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Clay Jenkinson, will portray the third president live and in costume. Merrill Pepcorn will read a Dakota Datebook. And Main Street's Doug Hamilton will moderate a distinguished media panel that includes Prairie Public's news director Dave Thompson, along with Amy Dalrymple of the Bismarck Tribune, the Grand Forks Herald's Mike Jacobs, Cecile Warman of Journal Publishing, and Forum Communications' Jack Zaleski. The event is free and open to the public. More information at history.nd.gov/events. The Good Government Summit, Sunday, April 15th, 1 to 4 p.m. in Bismarck.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined by Ross Lockhart. He's with the Northern Small Farm Alliance. They have an event this week at Shields Arena Conference Room in Fargo, and we'll talk about that. And we're going to start, Ross, with what is the Northern Small Farm Alliance?
The Northern Small Farm Alliance is a group of small-scale sustainable growers in based primarily here in the Fargo-Moorhead area. So we have member farms in North Dakota and Minnesota. And really our goal is to sort of work together and support one another and helping each other provide our communities with fresh, locally grown foods.
And you and your wife, Amber, operate a small farm. Tell us about Heart and Soil Farm.
Yes, Heart and Soil Farm is based out of Gardner, North Dakota, which is about 30 miles north of Fargo, Moorhead. We grow an assorted mix of fruits and vegetables on our farm, and we sell our produce through a couple of different avenues, one of which is a community-supported agriculture program. We also do farmers markets, and we sell through some wholesale venues such as the Prairie Roots Co-op here in Fargo.
And how big is a small farm? What's the definition here?
It's a pretty free-flowing definition. The reason we decided to call our group the Northern Small Farm Alliance is basically to provide an outlet for folks who are more or less getting started. And I think the small farm is one of the major outlets that people will or that newcomers are coming into agriculture. So we started the organization to be kind of that support mechanism, that resource for folks that are interested in agriculture but may not have the means or the family connection to get into agriculture. So We believe the small scale farm is one of a really great entry point for folks that are trying to get into the industry.
So how did you do it?
I do have that family connection. I'm a fourth generation farmer. So I grew up on a medium or even a large scale farm. But I left the farm. I left the farm after I graduated college, and I went off and explored the world and and decided to come back in 2012 and try my hand at something different. And I think it was, you know, having that experience off the farm really allowed us to, my wife and I, to want to try something different. And we thought, you know, growing fresh, sustainably grown produce was a unique avenue for us and something different. And so it allowed me to both be involved in agriculture but also, you know, start start growing in an industry that's really just getting up and running here in the Red River Valley.
Community sustainable agriculture, farmers markets, those have started to sprout up just about everywhere these days. But let's talk about your organization. How many members do you have in the Northern Small Farm Alliance?
Well, we started out small, believe it or not. We had about 7 farms that were part of the initial membership group. But it's a loosely affiliated group. We don't have a real formal structure. And I would say we're up to maybe about 20 members of people that have expressed interest in the organization and have supported us in our different events and activities that we conduct here in the area.
Well, there is a special event, as I mentioned, this Thursday, April 12th, at Shields Arena Conference Room in Fargo. It'll be the screening of a film called Farmers for America. Describe this documentary for our listeners.
Yes, it's Amber, my wife, and I. We had an opportunity to preview the film this past weekend, and I can say it's an incredible film. And it's all about celebrating farmers. So it doesn't necessarily have an agenda of different production styles, but it really, you know, looks at agriculture in the U.S. kind of all-encompassing. And the film highlights about a dozen different farmers across the U.S. and, you know, looks at different struggles that farmers are having and also the explosion of new farmers that are trying to get into the business. And how do we make that an easier transition for those folks?
Well, it does sound like a daunting transition. I have seen the trailer for Farmers for America, and there's some statistics that they throw out. The average age of the U.S. farmer is 60, which means that a number of them will be moving out of farming to, you know, their retirement years and not too distant future. What kind of opportunity does that present to small farmers?
Well, I think another statistic that was brought up in the film was that half of our agricultural lands are set to change hands in the next, I believe, decade. So really the film is about, you know, who will step into those roles and who will be growing our food. So I think it's imperative that we have these kinds of discussions and start thinking about, you know, really how are we going to make sure that we have a safe, sustainable food supply going into the future, given the fact that the number of farms in the U.S. is steadily declining and the average size of the farms are steadily increasing.
Which means that the capital investment is significant regardless of the size here, because when I was a kid growing up in Minnesota, I think a typical farm was about a quarter section, 160 acres maybe. Moved to North Dakota, farms are much bigger, and the land values have been going up and up and up. So what kind of a capital outlay does it take to become a small farmer with a big enough operation to sustain yourself?
As the Northern Small Farm Alliance, we are working on that issue. You know, what is an appropriate size and what kind of resources do you need? So obviously land is the biggest barrier for farmers, any farmers of any size. But when we're talking about small-scale farmers, you know, anywhere from 1 to 2 acres is a good starting point.
Okay, and is that ownership or even just leasing that land?
Well, that's another sticky issue, if you will, Doug. It's difficult for farmers, for beginning farmers, to find affordable farmland, especially when they perhaps are graduating from college and are coming out with significant student loans. Walking into the Farm Credit Service and asking for a loan almost becomes impossible because they look at you, well, you don't have any assets and you don't have any income. So how are we going to give you a loan for this land? So finding a lease agreement is oftentimes the easiest way for beginning farmers to get involved or to get their foot in the door. But it's, you know, I myself am a family farmer. So for me, it was a lot easier. And I recognize that that's not the case for everyone, and especially given the growth of new farmers that we see coming in are what we would consider first-generation farmers. So they wouldn't have that family connection. So, Yes, the capital outlays are significant, and that's a major barrier that we are working on as an alliance.
Well, the film will be shown Thursday evening at Shields Arena. The doors will open at 6 o'clock. There will be a panel discussion after Farmers for America is screened for that audience. So what is the direction you hope that discussion will take?
Well, we've brought together a really exciting panel. I think that we're trying to cover all our bases with the members of the panel. We have, if you don't mind, I'll just read out their names and give a preview of who will be involved. We have Mark Watney, who is the president of North Dakota Farmers Union. We have Russ Tweeten, who is a VP of Succession and Retirement Planning at Ag Country Farm Credit Services. And then we have a couple farmers as well. We have Rhonda Trainer, who is a rancher from Cogswell, North Dakota. We have Mark Askegard, who is an organic farmer south of Moorhead. And I'm most excited about our fifth panelist. Her name is Jen Skoog, and she is a beginning farmer. So she's just starting out, and I hope she'll be able to share her perspective on what it's been like, you know, being a beginning farmer and what it's taken for her to pursue her dream.
Well, you mentioned Mark Watney, the North Dakota Farmers Union president, and of course, that's one of the co-hosts of this particular screening coming up. So that's an important organization to have in your corner. Are there organizations in agriculture that are in opposition or just are creating barriers for what you do?
I wouldn't say creating barriers. I mean, I think we our goal is to celebrate farmers writ large.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there are groups that have different views and positions on what a farm should look like. So we don't always necessarily see eye to eye on...
They might have differences of opinion about organic as well, might they?
Yes, we definitely have an emphasis on organic and sustainable agriculture as part of the NSFA. But we think there's room in the marketplace for all types of farms, and we want to make sure that, you know, all farmers are allowed the opportunity to succeed, especially given the challenges that we're now seeing in agriculture and, you know, with all this talk of trade wars and things like that. It can be a difficult environment for farmers, and we need to really step back and think about, you know, this is our food system we're talking about, so we shouldn't monkey with it in such a reckless manner.
Well, decades ago, there were communities dotting the entire state of North Dakota that were sustained by the farmers around them. And, of course, the railroads came into the state, and they had to have water points within so many miles, and communities would sprout up there, and you'd have an elevator there maybe, and then decades ago, the railroad started to cut back and the elevators became bigger and those farms around those communities became bigger and there were fewer people to sustain those communities. So there's a shift in the population. There's a shift in the economic support for the state and those communities. Are we talking about kind of taking a step back to the way the things were? Is that a more ideal picture of North Dakota?
Well, certainly we believe that, you know, our rural communities in North Dakota are the backbone of the state. And when you have more people on the land, more people farming, you're going to have those small economies and those small towns thriving. You know, I don't make any, you know, notion that the farms should start getting smaller in size, but I think perhaps we need to look at the next generation of farmers and what they're interested in and providing them the opportunities to get started. And that could mean, you know, providing training opportunities or internships or a little bit easier access to land and perhaps even incentives for farmers, retiring farmers, to, you know, perhaps sell or rent to a beginning farmer.
Incentives. Can you describe that a little more specifically?
Well, just across the border in Minnesota, they recently passed a bill that would give farmers and ranchers who sell specifically to beginning farmers, so anyone who has been farming for less than 10 years, would give them a tax credit to sell or to rent to those folks. I think that's a really interesting model that maybe in North Dakota we should be looking at. But it's something that we can do, you know, from a policy perspective to incentivize and help new farmers get their foot in the door and get started.
As farms have gotten bigger and become in many states, not necessarily North Dakota, but more corporate in terms of their actual scale and the way they do things, they've linked up with the food distribution chains, and you've got supermarkets that offer tomatoes 12 months of the year and that kind of thing. Does the food distribution system need to be altered a bit to make room for what you're talking about?
I'm not sure it needs to be altered, but I certainly think that with consumer demand moving more toward local foods, and you know, we on our farm, we are, you know, seeing exploding demand for what we are producing and what we are selling in our local community. So, you know, we would advocate for the development of you know, more regionalized food systems where you have producers who are located in, you know, maybe 100, 200 mile radius of where the major population centers are, and growing and providing enough food to support those populations. We're certainly not there yet, but I think as consumers are looking at where their food is coming from and how it's being grown, I think those opportunities sort of naturally arise.
Now, the movie is called Farmers for America. Mike Rowe, who's a pretty well-known television personality, is narrating the film, so the voice will be familiar. Who should see it?
Well, we would invite everyone who's interested in eating to come and see this.
Well, that's pretty much all of us. So.
I mean, we are targeting farm organizations specifically because those are the folks who would be interested in learning more about different farming and farm systems. But anyone who has an interest in how their food is grown and where it's coming from would find this film very interesting. I'm very excited that we're showing it here in Fargo, and I think it should lead to a very good conversation afterwards.
If your ideal sort of view of agriculture could be realized, what would it look like in this country in your lifetime? How would it have changed?
I would just like to see that the ongoing trend of losing farms or the number of farms that are going out of business would stop, and that we could actually increase the number of farmers who find it as a viable career option. So that's what my ideal my worldview is, that we can just provide the right kind of opportunities for more farmers to get started.
All right. Well, Ross Lockhart with the Northern Small Farm Alliance, here to talk about a film opportunity for those of you who want to see the movie Farmers for America. It's April 12th at Shields Arena Conference Room. That's in Fargo. The doors open at 6. There will be a panel discussion afterwards. It is free and open to the public, and everybody's welcome. Next on Main Street, Dakota Datebook.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bremer Investment Services, with dedicated financial advisors offering financial plans for a secure future now and throughout retirement. Bremer Investment Services, for what's ahead.
The International Music Camp is taking registrations for its 63rd season at the International Peace Garden, offering over 40 week-long programs this summer, including band, choir, orchestra, dance, drama, piano, musical theater, and visual arts. There is also a four-day session for adults. The early bird registration deadline is May 1st and is available online at internationalmusiccamp.com.
Next time on Prairie Pulse, we'll talk with Tom Gerhart, the Public Affairs Director with North Dakota United, about their exciting new education podcast, and we'll have a musical performance from David Stoddard. That's next time on Prairie Pulse.
Friday at 7:30 on the television service of Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 10th. Dakota Territory was a decade away from statehood and nearing political upheaval after the death of Governor William A. Howard. In 1878, President Hayes had appointed Howard as Dakota's sixth governor. Howard was a mover and a shaker in the early Republican Party. He was a Michigan congressman for 6 years. After that, he was Detroit's postmaster and Michigan's Republican Party chair. His family was reportedly close with the Lincolns, and he cast Michigan's vote for Ulysses S. Grant in 1872 at the Republican National Convention. Grant offered Howard a diplomatic position to China in 1869, but Howard turned it down because of his health. Howard was also a railroad attorney and president. Two towns in Michigan were named after him. He ran unsuccessfully for U.S. Senator from Michigan in 1871. In 1876, Howard was crucial in nominating Hayes as the Republicans' presidential candidate. At the National Convention in Cincinnati, after six rounds of ballots, Howard stepped into the aisle on crutches and cast Michigan's vote for Hayes, who secured the Republican nomination for president and narrowly won the election. Hayes asked Howard to be governor of Dakota in 1878, and he accepted, though his health remained a concern. As governor, he opened the Dakota Hospital for the Insane in 1879 at Yankton after overcrowding in Minnesota hospitals where Dakota patients had previously been sent. He also sought to improve education in Dakota. Residents respected Howard as an able governor. On this date in 1880, Governor William A. Howard died from heart and lung troubles while on a visit to Washington, D.C. He was 67. New Hampshire state legislator Nehemiah Ordway would succeed him as governor. Ordway's appointment would bring political drama with charges of corruption and the friction caused by moving the territorial capital to Bismarck. Today's Dakota Daybook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
When I come back to them, I may be fonder and prouder than ever of my little women.
Joe, Meg, Beth, and Amy, iconic names in American literature. They are the March Sisters of Concord, Massachusetts, created by Louisa May Alcott in her timeless novel, Little Women.
Four small children is a recipe for heartache, headache, and indigestion.
A new masterpiece BBC television production will premiere on Prairie Public in May, but you can get a sneak peek at special one-hour premiere screenings on Sunday, April 29th at 2 p.m. at the Prairie Public Studio in Fargo and at the North Dakota Heritage Center in Bismarck. The event is free and open to the public, but please do let us know you'll be attending by registering at prairiepublic.org.
Mark Zuckerberg faces questions before Congress about the way Facebook's business practices affect the privacy of user data.
So it's very likely that we have hundreds of other apps that got the same great idea of just selling on the data.
A tech tycoon in the hot seat and the White House response to a suspected chemical attack in Syria on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Patrick Gulbranson, Chief Executive Officer for Family Healthcare, will join us to discuss how we compare to other countries in providing access to healthcare. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.